Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zhang. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show, and I have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our minds, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show today, I will bring you a conversation with Dr. David Burns. He's the Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Stanford University of Medicine and the best-selling author of Feeling Good and Feeling Great. We're going to talk about how to work with your negative beliefs. Then I will bring you Darren Gold, who is the managing partner at the Trium Group, where he advises and coaches CEOs and leadership teams at many of the world's most innovative companies, and the author of Master Your Code, The Art, Wisdom, and the Science of Leading an Extraordinary Life. We will talk about ways to become the author of your own life, choose your identity, and choose your results. So I'm going to tell you about the tip of the week. This week, I've been working on the subject of ways we might treat our mates as our children. Yes, that's what we do sometimes. Romantic relationships and marriages are under the construct of adult-to-adult relationship. However, many couples start that way and then end up with a parent-to-child relationship when they want to care, or a child-to-child relationship when they want to fight. A parent-to-child relatedness is when one partner holds a stance of up-to-down and that they know better, and therefore they correct the other, criticize the other, discipline the other person, punish the other. And on a caring level, they overcompensate for their mate's shortcomings, and they feel responsible for their mate's emotions and reactions and try to avoid getting them upset, analyze their behavior constantly, and give justifications for it. Usually in these types of relationships, the one who acts like a parent becomes resentful when they only have to pay attention to the other person and not care for their own needs. They feel angry when they have their own child and really want now a mate side by side for life with themselves, but end up having all the children at home, including their mate. They get tired of this role and end up living in an angry position, since the one they chose kind of like will never grow up. The one which is holding the child position gets tired of being corrected, scolded, being treated like they're less than, being controlled, not being respected for who they are, and given value for what they contribute. At one point, they get gravitated toward a person who shows up and sees them on a pedestal and they leave the relationship. So the one who holds the parent stance is left after sacrificing their time to raise the other and is left alone, since all children will leave the home someday, but with this one, with no appreciation and a lot of resentment. It is so important for the couple to become aware when they are not treating their mate as a capable and responsible adult and act like a parent, or the one who acts like a teen in the relationship and puts all the responsibility on their mate's shoulder. These relationships become unhealthy and toxic. Let's not forget that when a person chooses a mate, they're choosing them for all their greatness, strength, and compatibility. So it's important to keep that in mind when the differences show up. Each partner plays an important role. An adult is responsible for their own thoughts, feelings, needs, intentions, and behaviors. They are in a relationship for companionship and partnership. So in this role, each can communicate and negotiate respectfully for their needs and desires, each being responsible and committed to creating happiness for themselves and the other. So please commit to creating the greatest relationship that you can as an adult. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Dr. David Burns.
Thank you.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. You deserve it.
Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I am so excited to have Dr. David Burns with me. He is the adjunct professor emeritus in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Stanford University School of Medicine, and the author of the best-selling books, Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy, and The Feeling Good Handbook. And guess what? The good news is Feeling Great is coming up soon. So we're excited to have that book on in September. I always learn so much from you, Dr. Burns. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's always an honor to work with you, and always really fun too. So
thank you, Dr. Burns. With all this going on in regarding the coronavirus and the impact that it has had for a lot of people, I've come to work with many people who their thought process, and obviously with that their emotional process, goes from one extreme to the other. Many people, they catastrophize everything and everything becomes really harsh. Some people are past the initial phase, and they're really dealing with their own main issues now, because they're home, they're not being bombarded with a lot of the other stimulus from outside that they used to work and do everything. So they're going back in. So there's a way that you and your model team, TEAM, works with negative belief systems. And I know that in other episodes, we've talked about a particular model that you were talking about, which you were working with someone who were suffering because their husband was a physician and he was working. And you were coming to the place of really working with their negative belief. And I think that people who are watching us, they can really look at this the model that you're talking about and relate it in this format or any type of a negative belief system format that it's coming up for them at this time.
Yeah, I'll see if you didn't tune in yesterday. We're working with a young woman, Taylor, who's a psychologist, but her husband's an intensive care unit doctor on the front lines, and he's and also an ER doctor. So he's just working with Corona 16 hours a day, and three of his colleagues are in the intensive care unit because they got Corona, and they've been intubated, which is a grave sign. And he's worried that he might, and probably will, pick up the coronavirus. And then I've been working with his wife, who's in a state of intense panic about this, intense depression, intense anger, intense frustration. And she's, giving herself a lot of negative messages as well that are causing these feelings. And so after empathy, I go, it's testing, T equals testing. I got all measured all of her moods at the beginning. E equals empathy. I, I empathized with her, let her pour her heart out, provided support. And then comes A, which is assessment of resistance. And essentially, I asked her, now, is there something you want help with in today's session? And to make a long story short, she said what she wanted was all of her negative thoughts and feelings to disappear, because she's tired of, you know, sobbing for 30 to an, minutes to an hour every night and worrying constantly, am I going to lose my husband? So I said, if we had a magic button right here, and let's imagine that if you pushed it, all your negative thoughts and feelings would disappear. Would you press the button? And like just about everyone I work with, she says, yeah, show me the button, I'll press it. I'm tired of feeling so horrible. And then I said, well, you know, we don't have a magic button, but I've got fantastic tools. And I'm sure I could help you reduce these feelings dramatically today, but I'm not sure it'd be a good idea to do that. And then she, like everyone, said, well, why not, David? This is what I need. I've been suffering for weeks, you know, crying my heart out in fear, anger, agony, trying to manage my kids. I'm overwhelmed. And I said, well, before we use these tools, maybe we better see, what do these negative thoughts and feelings show about you that's positive and awesome? And this is the powerful, new, and totally unique feature of team therapy, to help the patient. I never try to help the patient. Instead, I'm going to try to argue that she should not change by showing her what's great about her negative thoughts and feelings. And that's the opposite to what 99% of mental health professionals do. And so I said, let's show, like, you're 100% sad. You're as sad as a human being can be, as depressed as a human being can be. What does that show you about you that's positive and awesome? What does it show about you and your core values? And what are some benefits to you in feeling tremendous sadness? And then it began to dawn on her that her incredible sadness and her 100% anxiety is actually an expression of her love for her husband, Greg, and her love for her kids and her love for her family. And that these feelings are beautiful that she has. And they show her vulnerability. And if you want, I'll send you a photo of her and her husband on the beach, you know, when they had first met. It's the most beautiful, you know, love picture you can imagine. And that's her feelings are an expression of that love. And if she presses the magic button, then the negative feelings disappear. But then it would be like saying, oh, my husband's about to die and I'm happy and euphoric. You see, it would be horrible. It's great to have those feelings. They show your vulnerability. They show what's most beautiful about you, Taylor. And she got that. And then another, what else is good about your anxiety? How is that going to help you? And she says, well, it's keeping us safe. And we got Greg to move, you know, six blocks away. So he's not going to, if he catches it, he's not going to bring it home and infect me and infect the kids. And I'm doing everything I can to protect him and to protect the kids. So we don't want the anxiety to go to zero either. The anxiety is healthy. It's not caused by a chemical imbalance in your brain, as the American Psychiatric Association would have us believe. It's an expression of what's beautiful about you. You're feeling bad, 50% bad. What's great about that? And then she said, well, it shows that I'm realistic and that we're, living in difficult circumstances here. It's appropriate to feel upset. The kids are here all the time. I'm having to manage them. I'm having to manage my patients. These negative feelings also help us connect on a deeper level, like help me connect on a deeper level. I hadn't seen Taylor since she was in my Tuesday group at Stanford. And since then, she's moved back to New York and developed this wonderful treatment program. And, you know, she used to come to every Sunday hike that I had. for 2 years, and we got to know each other well. And here it is a chance to for people to connect more deeply with these negative feelings. And then her loneliness shows that she's a social person, that she loves connecting to others. If she was not lonely, it would be like she didn't care about people. And her hopelessness and discouragement, it shows that she's realistic. Her husband is on the front lines. The danger that he'll get the coronavirus is exceptionally high. And so if she wasn't feeling hopeless and discouraged, she'd be not tuned in. And in addition, her hopelessness can protect her from disappointment. So she doesn't get her hopes up and then suddenly get crushed later on. Her frustration, she decided, shows that she's a problem solver, that she hasn't given up. And then her anger shows her passion and her desire to protect her husband from injustice. So that simple procedure, which took about 10 minutes, and then I say, well, now, Taylor, maybe you don't want to press that magic button. Let's say we had a magic dial and could just tune all the feelings down to some lower level. What would you want? And then I had her write these down as goals. And her goal for depression was to reduce it from 100 to 50. She said 50, that would be appropriate. How anxious? She wanted her anxiety to go from 100 to 20. She says, I don't need a whole lot of anxiety. You feel bad, 50. What would you like there? She said, I want it to go to 10. You feel lonely and abandoned, 90. How much do you want to feel there? She said, I want to feel 20. How hopeless do you want to feel? She wanted to go from 90 to 25, wanted her frustration to go from 100 to 5. And strangely enough, she only wanted her anger to go from 100 to 50. And that's the end of that third part of the session, the assessment of resistance. And I might say that what this does for the person is several things. First, when you see what's beautiful about your negative feelings, you don't have to be ashamed anymore. And our culture creates shame around, you know, mental disorders, so to speak. And I'm saying these aren't mental disorders for the most part. This is your core values speaking. Secondly, I'm making a deal with her subconscious mind, with her resistance. I'm not telling her what to do, and I'm not trying to rescue her. I'm trying to say, we'll reduce it to these levels, but not any lower. But then, of course, I told her we have to be careful because the techniques are so powerful. Like, you only want your depression to go from 100 to 50. It could drop as low as 10 or 15, but don't worry. If it goes that low, I'll help you get it back up to 50 before the end of the session. And that brought some laughter, and that's always a healing thing. But these goals, the goals can change once we get to working. And there's three or four other wonderful things about assessment of resistance, but since I can't remember what they are, I'll stop talking for the moment.
One of the things as you were talking came up for me with your model is that a lot of times, we split ourselves into the areas that we like about ourselves or feels good or it's joyous and it's comfortable. And then, you know, we set up a negative value for the areas where we don't like or it's uncomfortable or the feelings that are uncomfortable and the thought process that are uncomfortable. So we split them into a good or a bad, you know,
yeah,
an evil thing. And one of the things as you were sharing, it's you're allowing the person to bring these two sides together and look at everything that they named as a bad. Comfortable or I don't want it, and see the beauty also in that side of them. So they're also looking at their, no matter what, they're looking at their own beauty and everything that is right about them. Although it might appear that they named it as bad and I don't want it, that their resistance about not wanting it becomes less because you're looking at the beauty within it. So then they get to embrace whatever part of them and have it to be embracing it, and it's like it's all of me, and obviously it has a purpose that it's here, so I'm going to allow it. There's an allowance of having that area be present as is and do its function without fighting it, because the fighting part of it with us and our depression or anxiety, and it shouldn't be that way, I shouldn't be crying, I shouldn't feel hopeless and helpless and all of this, it puts a lot of pressure on that person. And you're kind of like eliminating that pressure and saying, this is all the beauty that you have, and they're all here for a purpose, so allow them to be. And then you could, you know, dial them down and do.
You really got it. I love the way you summarize that. And then the paradox. See, when you say, I shouldn't be so depressed, I shouldn't be so angry, it actually intensifies the negative feelings, and you get stuck in them, like fighting your way out of quicksand. And the harder you fight, the deeper you go. And paradoxically, once I can show you what's so beautiful about your hopelessness, your rage, your shame, whatever it happens to be, once you really see it's a good thing, paradoxically, you don't need it anymore. And another reason is because you're listening to what your negative thoughts and feelings are trying to tell you. And once you hear the music behind the negative feelings, then you don't need this 100% anymore, because you've gotten the message.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. As I say, I always learn from you. And for all of us who are viewing us, you can take all of what Dr. Burns has said and really look at yourself and see what parts of you may be pushing away, not accepting, and naming it bad, and how you can also embrace that and see what parts of you can rename, or look at the functionality of it and embrace it and love it and be empathetic to that part. And stay tuned, because we're going to be back with more episodes with Dr. David Burns. Thank you. Bye now.
Are you afraid? Are you getting panic attacks? Are you getting bored and can't stand it anymore at your home? Are you finding yourself in a bind with a relationship at home? Are you wondering what all of the fuss is? And are you determined to guard yourself against all others? Or worried about, how am I going to pay my rent or mortgage? In respect to the coronavirus stress, I'm offering a sliding scale online psychotherapy for anyone in California, and life coaching to anyone in the world who's suffering financially. Please connect with me at Foujan.com, Foujan.com.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Foujan Zain, and I am excited to have Darren Gold with us. Darren is a managing partner at the Trium Group, where he advises and coaches CEOs and leadership teams at many of the world's most innovative companies, including Roche, Dropbox, Lululemon, Sephora, Cisco, eBay, Activision, and Warner Brothers. He is the author of the new book, Master Your Code: The Art, Wisdom, and the Science of Leading Extraordinary Life. Welcome to the show, Darren.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on. I appreciate you having me.
Of course. Now, I went through your book, and I got excited. I got elated. I felt like I'm ready to go. You know, like, I got it. I want it. Ready to go. So that was my experience, and I hope that all of you out there who will get the book and enjoy it and have your own experience of it. So, Darren, you have spoken about how our beliefs shape our actions. Obviously, I'm a psychotherapist for 30 years, so I definitely work with a lot of beliefs. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about this book, actually, to be honest with you, is, you know, I do business coaching, I do life coaching, I do psychotherapy, but many of the books that are related specifically to business world or don't have the psychological aspect in it. And I really enjoyed your book, because obviously it was familiar to me, because I read a lot of the, you know, the psychological belief systems and theories that were there. And I really got that you've looked at all the angles, which I really enjoy. And I'm hoping that everyone who reads this book really enjoys it as much as I did. You said, how do our beliefs shape our actions? Can you share with us, from your perspective, how does that work?
Yeah, well, I'm a student of performance in the business setting. Most of my work is with, you know, very senior business leaders. And what I've noticed over the years is there's an architecture to performance. And it breaks down pretty simply into the following, which is we spend most of our time really looking at results. But when we start to see and ask the question, what drives results, the pretty obvious answer to that question is the actions we take, right? So there's nothing that mind-blowing in that part of the formula. The real interesting question is like, what's at the source of action? What determines the actions that I take and therefore the results that I get? And really, I think if I were to say, where does the book aim, is at this question of what is the source of action? And what we begin to see when we study human behavior, and I know that you're very familiar with this, is that if we want to change the actions and therefore the results we get, we have to attend to our underlying psychology. And maybe the most important part of our psychology are the beliefs that we have constructed. And the basic assertion of the book is that our beliefs are, number one, constructed, which is for many people a pretty novel realization or notion, which is, wait a second, I make up my beliefs? And of course we do, right? We construct them largely in response to our environment. They're usually safety-based, and they really drive the actions we take and therefore the results we get. And so if we want to take different actions and get different results in any dimension of life, whether it's business or family or any dimension, we have to begin to understand and reshape and shift the beliefs that we hold. And the book makes an assertion that this is essentially the human superpower, is the ability to choose the beliefs we hold. And it's in that choice that we have access to a more effective and more extraordinary life. And the book asserts that there are essentially 10 major choices or declarations we can make around the beliefs that we hold that are really fundamental to living life well.
Can we talk about the 10?
Sure.
You know, there's a key into changing our belief systems. And one of the first one is the awareness of it. We've got to know what it is before we could actually change it or attempt to shift it. Let us know.
Yeah, I think for most people, and this was true for me for quite some time, we go through life really unaware that we hold beliefs. We just see the world and we believe it is the way it is, without really understanding that the way we see the world is a byproduct or a function of the beliefs we hold. I share in the book a story of the two shoe salesmen who take a long boat journey over the years 1900 from London to a developing country, and they get off and they walk into the village. The first shoe salesman looks out and says, "Oh my gosh, no one here wears shoes. Total disaster. I'm going to be on the next boat home." The other shoe salesman says, "Glorious opportunity. No one here wears shoes yet. Please send more inventory fast." And it's a really interesting illustration of the way we see the world, the way the world shows up to us, and therefore the actions that we take. One shoe salesman says, "I'm going home." The other says, "I'm getting more inventory," is a function of the beliefs we hold. And so the very first chapter deals with this awareness. And if we're going to really be the author of our lives, we have to be aware of the beliefs that we hold. And it's in that awareness that we discover this human superpower that I get to choose the beliefs that I hold. I can choose beliefs born out of scarcity or fear, or I can choose beliefs born out of optimism and hope and possibility. And the choice is yours to make. It's not easy, but it will drastically and pretty radically transform the quality of your life.
Absolutely. You know, I created a model, awareness integration model, which talks about where do beliefs come and how do we go not only be aware of it, but also take away some of the beliefs that we got through trauma, such as what you just talked about. Yeah. Many times we create a ceiling for ourselves and we limit ourselves because of something that showed up. Either we took it on from our family's culture that in order to keep safe, so it was easier just to kind of take on what they had and continue it as a belief. And that shows up a lot in businesses also. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, some of it that got created with trauma. I remember looking at creating a lot of new businesses. And then right when it got to a certain point, I was like, okay, I'm done. I need to sell it or I need to move on. And then at one point I looked at and I thought, that's interesting. That's exactly what my father did. He was an entrepreneur, which he took in businesses, brought them to the country. And then within 2 years he sold them. So he didn't have, he chose or whatever his choices were, which I don't know where they were, but the results showed that there was no skills beyond keeping and maintaining something beyond 2 years. And it was interesting that when I got that, it's like, I've never had that in my community of my family. So if I wanted something more, I needed to get off that belief system and actually learn it from out there, be interested, because if I just went with the reservoir of the experience that had come to me, those experiences would only limit me to whatever my parents had. And to go kind of like, you know, beyond that threshold that we keep ourselves in there. But awareness was the first key to really opening that up.
Yeah. I mean, what you're pointing to is something fundamental, which is we develop, you know, what I call in the book, a program, a set of subconscious safety-based beliefs, values, and rules that really drive our behavior, automatically drive our behavior and limit our results. In many ways, they serve us. But our environment, particularly our childhood environment, is one where the thing that's most important for us is psychological survival, to be loved, to be safe, to be included. And so we begin to subconsciously adopt a set, you know, hundreds of beliefs, values, and rules that automatically drive our behavior, limit our results. And what you're pointing to is the discovery of that program, the awareness. And then the awareness that you can have some agency in reshaping it, rewriting it, really, in what I call mastering your code, which is a distinction that I offer as opposed to a program. A code is a consciously chosen set of beliefs, values, and rules that's purposefully designed to really serve you and lead to an extraordinary life. And so the premise of the book is this process of self-mastery, which is beginning to discover what are these rules and beliefs and values. Sometimes, like, it's interesting to know where they came from, sometimes not, but like, do I have to be run by them? Mm-hmm. Or can I say, here's where they serve me and here's where they limit me? What would a more expansive set of rules and beliefs and values be that would really serve me? And I joke somewhere in the book, I say, you know, I was almost 40 years old when I woke up to the fact that I was being run by a program written by a 7-year-old boy. And there's something really like funny and absurd in that realization when you're like, oh my gosh. And I oftentimes I'll make the analogy to a smartphone. I said, imagine trying to run your iPhone or your smartphone on an operating system from 5 years ago. It would be impossible. And we're doing that pretty much metaphorically. We're trying to run our adult lives on an operating system written by a child. And so the opportunity is to upgrade the operating system. And, you know, that can be sometimes a helpful analogy for people, particularly in our sort of technological world that we live in.
Definitely. What is the one belief that is most important to leading through the uncertainty, especially the uncertainty of this past, let's say, 8 months and the next year, since it has hit businesses so hard, and everyone who is either is a business owner or works for businesses, this is going to, maybe none of our old beliefs will ever work again. Maybe none of them can hold us and pass through. And it's so uncertain that I watch my clients that are business owners or small business owners, or, you know, they're multi-billion dollar corporations and they're CEO of those corporations, and they have no idea what else will happen. And it's such an in the moment making predictions and then coming back and doing something, and whoops, tomorrow something changes again. Share with us, based on your perspective and your book, work through this uncertainty?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's one, what I would call sort of meta belief, that may be the most important belief that we hold. And offers the opportunity for greatest growth. And that is the belief that we hold about our circumstances. And I devote an entire chapter to it. And I start referencing a psychological concept that I'm sure you're familiar with, which is called locus of control. And this is something we've known for now 50 plus years, that human beings lie somewhere on a spectrum in regards to the beliefs around my ability to shape my circumstances. On one end of that spectrum is a very powerful belief, an internal locus of control, what I call a responsible mindset, which says I shape my circumstances. There's always something I can do to affect any situation. I go so far as to say I'm 100% responsible for every situation. It's pretty radical. On the other end of the spectrum is a very common and what I would call the default human belief, which is circumstances shape me, events happen to me, there's very little I can do to affect my situation. And sometimes that's true, but it's not a very powerful belief to hold. And so a lot of the work that I do, even with very senior business leaders, is to have them begin to notice, when are they operating out of an external locus of control, what I call a victim mindset? You know, when do they render themselves powerless by saying the situation is so overwhelming, so complex, there's very little I can do? And we usually are in that mode when we're complaining, judging, or blaming. And we're doing that all the time. And so I offer one of the most powerful ways to switch into a responsible mindset, this belief that I shape my circumstances, there's always something I can do, is to ask the question, what would I do if I were 100% responsible for this situation? And people don't like that question because it oftentimes they mistake it for blame. I'm blaming myself. And that's really not what I'm talking about. You're never going to be 100% responsible. But if you assumed you were and asked that question seriously, what will appear are a set of actions that are totally new. And that's where we get effective action and better results. And so if I were to say, what's one belief and one triggering question to get you into that belief that will help us in these really complex, uncertain, volatile times, it's this notion of I'm 100% responsible for every situation, even though that may not be true. And I start by asking the question, what would I do if I were 100% responsible, is a incredibly empowering shift.
It really is. There's one thing that shows up as I've worked with people where when they are faced with that question that I am responsible, this fear of the enormous concept of, well, for sure, I'm going to fail, shows up. And the fear of failure many times makes us not only play small, play the victim, and hold on to beliefs that certainly has not worked for us. We have the result. We have tangible result that it doesn't work for us. Mm-hmm. But at least it's more like it's the familiar belief that at least I know it doesn't work versus it's changing it to a belief that now I have to face that it might not work.
Yeah.
So this fear of failure, when some people say it's a fear of success, I'm like, no, even the fear of success is more like then what happens after that. It's like, can I sustain that success? Can I maintain that success? And then if I go all the way there and then I fail, it's really a big fall. So, you know, I might just stay here. What are your thoughts about that area of fear that holds us, doesn't let us change our beliefs or shift to something bigger and shift to, let's say, the reality of, at least I'm responsible for my part. Even if that part is real, the other part could be an assumption which I can operate from, but even the minimum part of, right, I'm responsible for my thoughts, my emotions, my behaviors, and even taking responsibility for that, it's almost like, then I have to take responsibility for all my results. Well, then it might mean that I failed. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's number one, it's very common. We all operate from some place of fearing, you know, what would it look like to fail? And I think the thing that holds in place a victim mindset is a massive short-term payoff. And the short-term payoff is I get to avoid responsibility. I get to point the finger and externalize responsibility. So if things don't go well, I have somebody to blame. And that's understandable. We are sort of conditioned as children, right, to operate from that place. And it does really give you a short-term benefit. In the long term, what you're pointing to is it deprives us of massive growth and satisfaction and joy and fulfillment and agency and power and effectiveness in life. And so for some people, it requires what the late leadership expert Warren Bennis, called a crucible event. But I have some event in my life that finally, right, gets me to confront, do I want to keep playing it safe, or what Larry Wilson called playing not to lose, or do I want to play to win in life? And it's a big jump. And it's a big jump that I have a lot of empathy for much of my early adulthood. You know, as I look back and I'm really honest with myself, it was a largely playing not to lose strategy. And in some respects, it takes some life experience, a little bit of pain and suffering, that you become tired of the results that you get from a playing not to lose strategy. And you begin to develop the maturity and courage to recognize that we have one life to live. It's not that long. And the long-term benefits of playing to win, to taking risks, to being comfortable owning responsibility is an empowering place. And the work that I do is a lot about making this shift. And sometimes it's subtle, sometimes it's pretty drastic and dramatic, but everybody is facing it. It offers an extraordinary benefit if you're willing to take it on, and not everybody is.
Yes. You talk about shifting from looking at I am who I am, which is a fixed position, to the I'm the author of my life. Mm-hmm. And looking from a perspective of being an author of your life, it takes that kind of an awareness. And you talk about the reaching the adult stage of development. I love this conversation, because at the beginning of the show, I speak about how much it's important for us to be the adult in our relationship, in talking about marriages and internal relationship, but how much it's important to be in adult stage when you are also in business. Sometimes in business meetings, what I experience, and I'm sure you experience it in your way, which is I experience people who have sibling rivalry with each other in the meeting. It's almost like they exactly the same way that they've had their sisters or brothers, or whether they were the only child or the older child, the same dynamic shows up constantly it takes them right to their childhood and the way that they deal with each other. Or like in relationships. And sometimes I look at a person and see that they have, if they have reached that adult stage of development within themselves, then you could see it across the board in all relationships. Sometimes you see someone which acted as if, because they learned it in that environment, to act as an adult and think like an adult in one area of relationship, but they haven't really transferred it to another areas of their life. And I really enjoyed when I read that in your book and saw that it's there. Can you share a little bit about that perspective?
Yeah, well, I'll bridge it to one of the concepts in the book, and it goes to the comment you made earlier around trauma, whether it's severe trauma or, more commonplace trauma. We all as children experience some traumatic event where our self-worth is questioned, where we don't feel loved, where we don't feel included. And I speak about in the book that in that moment of not feeling safe, not feeling included, not feeling loved, whether it was you were teased or bullied or treated unfairly, you will develop what I call a survival strategy. Some strategy that makes you feel safe and included and avoids you feeling the pain of that event. Now, for me, I emigrated to this country when I was 8. I had an English accent. I can tell you it was very cool to be 18 in California with an English accent, not very cool at age 8. And so I was teased by that accent. And I didn't know it at the time. But in retrospect, what I figured out was in that moment, I put in place a survival strategy. And the survival strategy was be liked and likable at all costs. And I lived out of that strategy, even into my adulthood. Now, that strategy served me well in many ways, and it really limited me. I had a really hard time being direct and honest with people. When I got into leadership positions, I was very reluctant to give people direct feedback. I robbed them of development. And you could see how my likability skills on the one hand probably served me, and on the other hand were really holding me back because I was a prisoner of these rules and strategies that I had developed as a child. And so as we move into increasing stages of adult development, we begin to not only see these rules for the first time, but we begin to self-author and say, wait a second, that was a rule that was sort of written for me, so to speak. You know, it was written when I was very, very young for good reasons, right? And they served me well at the time. I need a new set of rules. And so it's this developmental stage, which some psychologists call self-authoring, which is I begin to be the author of my own set of rules. And that happened for me. I said, wait a second, no longer do I have to be likable. It's not a bad thing, but I don't need to be driven by it, right? I can be likable when I need to and put my likability at risk when I need to. And the range of actions that was available to me out of that developmental stage was enormous. I'm now able to have direct and honest and kind conversations with people in ways that I just couldn't. And I didn't even know why I couldn't, right? It just wasn't available to me. And so this is this notion of as we move through increasing stages of development, we begin to have more agency over the kinds of rules that are running us. And rather than run us, we're intentionally authoring them so that we're mastering our lives, not the other way around.
And you talked about owning our own identity and bringing language in order to support us to create those identity and the choices and beliefs and character. Yeah. And this concept of the responsibility also, that what comes out of my mouth is not only what I'm choosing, but I'm intending to be, so that I am my word when I say it. I am my word when I look at being responsible and accountable, then my word are representation of who I am. And words, sometimes we only talk about it as if how I choose to say something to you outside. I would also extend it to what you say to yourself inside. Yeah. To own that that identity. Can you share your perspective from owning our own identity?
Yeah, it's so critical. I think next to the responsible mindset, this notion of the beliefs I hold about myself are so critical. And I'm really glad that you mentioned this distinction around language, which I think is important. The language we use when we speak to ourselves, which we're doing, by the way, all the time, right, is so, so important. We are actually declaring and creating, when we use language, a reality that shapes who we are. And so I offer in this book this notion of identity, that we, much like we hold beliefs about our circumstances and others and the world, we hold critical beliefs about ourselves, about our own capabilities and possibility. And these beliefs, like all beliefs, were formed early in life. They were largely formed to keep us safe, not necessarily for us to thrive. And the aggregation of these beliefs is what I call our identity. So we're all walking around with an unconscious identity. And if you look at human behavior, the most fundamental driver of human behavior is the desire to be consistent with your identity. In fact, it's almost impossible for you to take an action that's inconsistent with the subconscious identity you're holding. So if you want to take more effective actions, get better results in life, you got to have an extraordinary identity, because those two things have to go hand in hand. And so one of the real breakthroughs that I offer in the book, and it was for me and in the work that I do, is this notion that, wait a second, I hold all these beliefs about myself. I'm not even sure I even know what they are. I've never examined them. And like any belief, they're all made up so I can reconstruct them. I call it identity reconstruction. We have this opportunity to powerfully redeclare beliefs about ourselves, beliefs that are going to really lead to the kind of results that we want in life. And that is a big, big opportunity. And it's an important part of what I offer to people as a daily practice, was this notion of an identity statement. that we begin to consistently assert beliefs about ourselves that will conform to the kind of life that we want to live and lead.
So a short time left. So one, I want to ask you if there's anything we haven't spoken about that you really want the listeners or the audience, the viewers to know about your book and your knowledge and wisdom that you really want to share with them. And if you could also add, in the time of pandemic as we're going through, whether it's for businesses or people who are working or living in this time of uncertainty, what is a gift that you could give them to pull them through this time?
Great. Well, let me answer those in the order you asked them. So I think there was, as I finished writing the book, the first draft of the book, I had originally intended to have a chapter on kindness. And for whatever reason, I just couldn't write one that I was really satisfied with that was unique enough and powerful enough. And I ended up writing an epilogue around kindness. So the thing that I would want to add to make this conversation feel more complete is just the importance of love and kindness and compassion. Those are beliefs, much like anything else. And I think what our world needs now more than anything else are people who lead from a place of kindness and love and compassion and forgiveness. I do have a whole chapter on forgiveness. As opposed to seeing the world and seeing themselves and seeing each other through the lens of anger and resentment and blame, which is unfortunately what we're seeing a lot of today. So I think that's as much as the other things that we've talked about in terms of action and results and performance, there's this importance of kindness and love for me is paramount. The thing that I would offer as a daily, I'm a big believer in daily practices, daily rituals. If you study, you know, people that have done extraordinary things throughout history, most of them have a practice or a ritual that they engage in. That I like to say that the very act of doing something each and every day without exception, doesn't matter what it is the act of an extraordinary person. So if you want to be extraordinary, however you define that, you know, lead a fulfilling and joyful life, doing something consistently every day is a hallmark of that. And the thing I really recommend is to do something early, first thing in the morning. For me, it starts with a declaration. The first thing I do when I gain consciousness, I wake up, is I say, thank God I'm alive. This is going to be an extraordinary day. That's something that takes 2 seconds that you can do every single day. But then I advise take 10 minutes. And I call it 10 minutes that will change your life. To do something consistently, whether it's a gratitude practice, a journaling practice, a meditation, whatever it is that works for you, doing something that begins to prime you emotionally and psychologically and physiologically, a breathing exercise, a little bit of light yoga, whatever it is, will begin to put you in the ownership seat of how your day is going to show up. Either your day is going to own you or you're going to own your day. And the difference between those two things oftentimes is a daily practice that's intentional and done with consistency.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Everyone, Darren Gold, his latest book, Master Your Code, The Art, Wisdom, and the Science of Leading an Extraordinary Life. You can find him at darrenjgold.com. Thank you so much, Darren, for being on my show.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
And for all of you out there, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, bye-bye.